Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard and the foremost expert on authoritarianism, Steve Levitsky. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet for @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And other exciting news, the documentary Carville, Winning is Everything Stupid, is now streaming on Max. Get updates and some great behind-the-scenes content by following James on Twitter, @JamesCarville, and on his new TikTok, @RealJamesCarville. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, The Washington Post, ZBiotics, and HelloFresh. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. James, the big news was that Joe Biden, after insisting he would not, one of the most comprehensive ever, maybe the most, his son, Hunter Biden. If this pardon were issued under the very same circumstances with Nikki Haley or Mitt Romney as president, I would be outraged. It would be an indefensible act of nepotism after doing something he said he wouldn't do. I don't like pardons of big shots, no matter who the president is. The sleaziest of all, of course, was Donald Trump in 2021. I think Hunter Biden illicitly traded on the family name. And I think politically, this is going to hurt Democrats some. It'll give Trump an excuse. It won't give him an excuse because he's going to do it anyway, but he'll claim that I'm just doing what others are doing. However, after that long buildup, James, if I were in Joe Biden's shoes, I'm afraid I would have done the same thing. Why? Does anyone doubt if he hadn't and Hunter Biden went to jail, Donald Trump would have maliciously used this for leverage? For example, passing the word in the spring to Joe Biden, I'll pardon your kid if you acknowledge I won the 2020 presidential election. Or if not, you know, maybe we'll have to transfer him to a prison like Hazelwood. You might recall that's where Whitey Bulger was murdered upon arrival. That certainly would be typical Trump. And as much as I hate this pardon and as much damage as I'm afraid it's going to do, I can see how leaving your son at the mercy of Donald Trump would be unconscionable.
Well, I agree with everything, but even if I had a kid and he did do some things. You know, a lot of the stuff he did was when he was not addicted, okay? It was probably overblown. I would have pardoned my kid no matter what. If they were saying they were going to have 24-hour cell protection, but they were going to be in jail for 2 years, no way that I wouldn't have pardoned one of my own children. And everything you say, I completely agree with. But the central point, All of this is the most tragic figure in American politics in my lifetime is President Biden. All right. So he said, I'd never pardon a kid. Okay. I don't believe any. When anybody says I never had sex with that person, I'd never pardon my kid, I don't pay any attention to it because I think everybody lies about sex and everybody is going to do whatever they're going to do with their own children. But the different scenario would be if he would have, in September of 2023, or August, said that he wasn't going to run. God damn, we would have won this election, and it wouldn't have been that close because we'd have had so many freaking talented people that were running. And he would be sitting here right now, getting ready to leave, on a high note. There would be naming commissions to figure out what we're going to name after him. He would be the toast of Washington. There would be a Democratic inauguration coming up. Then a new Democratic president could have sort of gotten away with commuting any sentence that Hunter Biden got. And it would have been minimal. It'd have been some pushback, but, you know, in the interest of the Biden family and President Biden's long and distinguished service to the community, I'm going to commute the sentence. You wouldn't even have had to have pardoned it. I just cannot get away from the fact that somebody that I really liked and admired my entire political life, I could never remember when in the 70s reading the first edition of the Almanac of American Politics about this guy in his 30 years old elected to the Senate from Delaware. And all of this is fucking self-inflicted. It's tragic. It's sad. And of course, he's everything about him is no one's good. It'll be 6 years before somebody comes back and talks about all of the stunning things of manufacturing that he's brought back.
James, it'll probably be longer. You're absolutely right, but it'll probably be longer than 6 years.
It'll be a while. Yeah. What's so sad, it didn't have to be this way. He bought it all on himself. And I know the people around him, whether they at his beck and call or the employees, the consultants, his wife, who, according to press reports, unsurprisingly, you know, really took on his side. I understand all of that. But at the bottom of this, Joe Biden is and will continue to be the most tragic figure in modern American politics. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Well, I agree. He was right up there with Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, at least. I think that, you know, I will say this. I think some of the GOP House members, James Comer and Jim Jordan, said this is outrageous. This pardon was to cover up the Biden family crimes. These two clowns spent the better part of 2 years trying to find dirt on Biden. And you know who their top two sources were? They had two sources. They were really big ones. One ended up a suspected Chinese agent, the other a Russian agent. You know, poor Comer just isn't very smart. And Jordan has managed, with the help of the Ohio justice, to dodge credible and multiple allegations that he covered up a sexual assault case with Ohio State wrestlers. So, you know, I will complain about the pardon. Others can complain about the pardon in a different context. But don't pay any attention, for God's sakes, to people like Comer and Jim Jordan, who never raised any objections to Trump's pardons of the sleaziest of all, Roger Stone and Paul Manafort.
So I'll nitpick just a little bit. I think the Johnson analogy is somewhat analogous. Nixon was a crook. Biden is the most uncrooked person that you could imagine. I mean, he's certainly a Washington creature. He's a cozy with lobbyists, but I don't think he's a dishonest man. All right? Lyndon Johnson bought a lot of this, and I do think he's a figure, but he bought a bad policy. Biden was not a crook, and he had no bad policies. That's a blanket statement. He wasn't brought down by bad policies. He was. That's what makes him so staggeringly tragic. What he did, I don't think he had any choice to do what he did with his son Hunter. Now, you know, what he could, you know, I'm sure that given up, and his whole life history is so tragic, his wife and kid, auto accident, the man like to die with an aneurysm, all right? His son, Bo, who he worshipped, who was apparently a terrific human being, was a Iraq War veteran, was going to be governor of Delaware, you know, died of a brain tumor. I just, when I go back and I think about Joe Biden and his life and what he meant and how he is an honest man that did so many good things, and he will never live, you will never live, to see him get justice. And it's all so fucking self-inflicted. I mean, Johnson, you know, with Doris Kearns Goodwin, you know, she got a very soft spot for Johnson. He got roped into something by all of the smart people, you know, to David Halberstam, the best and the brightest, people ought to read that five times, all right? That is the most searing indictment of just blindly following credentialism that you can never think of. And it's just, Albert, I actually feel for Biden, and he knows that he fucked up, and he wasn't crooked. He didn't pursue bad policies. He has a most tolerant, loving, caring, non-prejudiced person you can imagine. And this is what he's faced with. It's a fucking shame.
Yeah. Oh, it is so sad. It is so sad. James, I apologize for being repetitious, but every week of the Trump transition reminds us of the Louisiana River that the natives say has no bottom. And we, you know, we go deeper and deeper into the muck. This week it was Kash Patel to head the FBI. Even though, first of all, the law says the current director, Christopher Wray, who, by the way, was appointed by Trump for a statutory 10-year term and has done a very good job, has 3 more years. Screw the law, is the Trump mantras. Get rid of Wray and let's put in our guy. Now, let's look at Patel for a minute. He is a former aide to the discredited chair of the old chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes. Patel is a total Trump sycophant. That's his only qualification. He makes clear that's what all he wants is to do what Trump wants. In the first administration, they tried to foist him off on Attorney General William Barr, who said, "Over my dead body will I take that jerk." Then they tried the CIA director, who said he's so lethal and unqualified, I'll quit if you send him over to the agency. But he has a chance to be confirmed, James, because lemmings like Senator Chuck Grassley, a 91-year-old around the bend, says he's just the guy to reform the FBI. Reform. Oh, he's got an enemies list to go after anyone that Trump doesn't like, former Republican officials, prosecutors, generals, the media. This guy, if he does get confirmed, is going to make J. Edgar Hoover look like a civil libertarian. It's just, there are a whole lot of bad appointments. This is right at the top, James.
Well, okay, this goes to my point. When I still say, people mock it. Tucker Carlson is the most powerful person vis-a-vis an incoming administration in history. Of course, Kash Patel was Tucker Carlson's business partner. Of course, where's Tucker Carlson now?
Russia.
Oh, yeah, okay. And if people don't want to wake up to what's going on, you know, go ahead and sleep. And in every instance that you look at, you can see Tucker's hand. And as I pointed out, he's 1,000 times more clever than these other people. It's all about resentment. And we're just going to get more, and most of these people can't stand the meritocracy. They can't, you know, Project 2025 is nothing but a bunch of like not even single A ball players, academics. And they, number one thing is revenge. And Kash Patel is going to give them revenge. And that just is another illustration of Tucker's power. The fucking FBI director is now, I'm telling you, are they going to give Putin the names of assets that the United States has in Russia? I really fear that. If I were cooperating with the CIA in internal Russia and I hated Putin, I would, let me give you a piece of advice. Get the fuck out of there. They're gonna dime you, man. They're gonna give your name to Putin, and they're gonna give the names of all of the people that we, you know, these agents recruit people. Sometimes they pay them. They have a lot of different motivations. Some of it's money. Some of it's they just don't like Putin. There's all kinds of things. Get, in the name of God, protect your families and get the fuck out of there, because they're gonna give these names to Putin. You can see that coming. I promise you, get out and get out now.
Yeah. You know, and if he doesn't, Tulsi Gabbard may, if she gets confirmed. But the one that really is on the chopping block now, I hope Patel will be there eventually, but he may not be. But Defense Secretary, the nominee for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, a New Yorker piece by the fabulous Jane Mayer, will enable him to soon return Hegseth to Fox News. He's in the toaster now. James, by the time this podcast airs, he may well be toast. Among Jane's revelations in the New Yorker, Hegseth was 10 years ago in over his head in running a small nonprofit, had no idea how to run it. So what does Trump want to do? Give him a $1 trillion Pentagon budget to run. He was repeatedly intoxicated, associates said. This drinking problem surfaced in a number of ventures. The man has or had a drinking problem. 35 years ago, that killed the Pentagon nomination of a far more qualified John Tower. He led and he created a hostile workplace for women. Sexual indiscretions were a game in places that Hegseth ran. And in the previously reported incident of sexual assault at a California conference, the woman said Hegseth assaulted her. He says he was the victim. Really? His lawyer claimed officials had records of previous accusations this woman had made. So Jane filed a public information request. The answer, there were no other charges. Hegseth's lawyer was wrong or he lied. And James, finally, now you're going to think I'm making this up, but I promise. Somebody came to Hegseth's defense after Jane's piece. It was a guy named Sean Parnell who said all these charges, I worked with him about sexual stuff and drinking, they were false. Now, who was Sean Parnell? He had to drop out of a race for the U.S. Senate several years ago after a judge in a divorce proceeding found credible the charge that Parnell physically abused his wife, ordered her out of a car on a highway when she was 6 months pregnant, and told her to get an abortion. Where in the hell do they come up with these people, James?
First of all, Pete Hegseth is toast. I mean, Jane Mayer buttered him, all right? So he's not going to survive. The backstory, Tinkers to Evers to Chance, right? Trump to DeSantis to Lara Trump in the United States Senate. If you can read this pitch 50 feet from the home plate, they're going to dump Hegseth. They're going to connive to give DeSantis, because he was a Navy veteran, he's actually in JAG, but whatever, okay, point him Secretary of Defense, and on his way out, he is going to appoint Lara Trump to fulfill the whatever unexpired term of Marco Rubio.
Yep.
This is just right in front of everybody's face what's going on here. And, you know, DeSantis is going to look a weird guy, as you can imagine. He uses a state dime, everything else. But that's what you're looking at. You're looking at, and I suspect that Susie Wiles, it doesn't, you don't have to be that clever political person to figure out what's going on here. And so, you know, alongside Margaret Chase Smith and Barbara Mikulski and Patty Murray and all the great female senators that we've had in the United States Senate, now welcome to Lara Trump. That, at least she's not a, to my knowledge, she's not a drunk or a serial sexual molester. So I guess in this world, she's probably fucking Winston Churchill or something.
And I'll tell you something. If this happens, and if Governor DeSantis takes this, be prepared, Governor, to be tortured by Donald Trump. There's nothing he likes more than to torture people who once opposed him and make them lapdogs. You know, you better be ready for that, Ron. Although I don't have any sympathy for Ron.
I don't have any sympathy for him either, but it's going to end up for shitball of them. Okay? I'm sorry. It all goes back to one person. It all goes back to Joe Biden. That's why we're in this fucking mess. Plain evident as it can be.
It is. Okay, we'll be back with to see if that river gets deeper.
It's going to get deeper. That river is not in Louisiana anymore. If you stick a map, 10th through the end of the other side of the, I don't know where, is it in Pakistan now? It's just gone fucking somewhere. But it ain't got no bottom in this hemisphere, I can tell you that.
All right, we will be back. Hey, James, our guest is Stephen Levitsky, a Harvard political scientist and the foremost expert on authoritarianism and the threats to democracy. He's written several great books on this subject. Steve, you have written that Trump was the most open authoritarian candidate in a democracy since World War II. In the month since he was elected, what are the most dangerous or confirming signs of this that you've seen?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that authoritarianism in the 21st century isn't like the authoritarianism of old. We're not going to see Trump declare martial law or suspend the Constitution or cancel elections or ban the opposition. What we're going to see, the core authoritarian activity we're going to see, is good old-fashioned deploying the machinery of government against your rivals. This is what Republicans have admired all these years in Hungary in Viktor Orban. It's simply deploying the government against your rivals. You packing the critical agencies of the state, from the tax agencies to the FCC to the FTC to the Justice Department to the FBI, and deploying those institutions against your rivals until you grind them down. That's what we're going to see. And Trump has already moved in that direction.
With his appointments. Steve, all right, Orban's Hungary is the model. How quickly do you expect Trump to move?
That's a good question. I mean, the early signs are that he'll move pretty quickly. Now, Trump is not a particularly disciplined or competent guy. His team, his coalition is a real mix of billionaires and populists and pragmatists and ideologues. And I think they're going to be a mess in many ways. It's not clear how effectively, this is not a well-oiled machine, and it's not going to be a well-oiled machine. And that works for those of us who care about democracy, that works to our benefit. We've never had anything like this in the United States. It's really hard to know how quickly he'll move, but the early appointments suggest he wants to move pretty quickly.
Well, if he does, and the efficiency with which he does it is underestimated, James and others have noted that the opposition is despondent, not as eager to join the fray right now. You have said that the establishment may be, quote, sleepwalking toward a crisis, end quote. If that's the case and there's not an effective resistance that's formed soon, immobilized soon, it may be too late.
I don't think it'll be too late, Al. It is a shame, and it is a problem if the opposition or if American society is too exhausted or too resigned or too complacent to act. I think there's a real risk of that. I mean, it's been 8 years for both small D and large D Democrats fighting off Trump, and this was just a huge gut punch. And so activists around the country, journalists across the country, politicians are really exhausted, really despondent, as you said. Many of them are going to be tempted to step to the sidelines just to sort of pack it in. And that's a problem. But I don't think, even if it takes 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, even if it's not until the midterm elections that the opposition sort of gets its breath, I don't think it's too late. I think we'd be better off if we were rearing and ready to go in January, but our institution, the opposition is strong enough and our institutions are strong enough that we're not going to be in 1933 Germany if it takes us a year to get it together.
Well, yeah, to be sure. I hope you're right, but I worry that a lot of damage will be done in that year, and some damage will be hard to overcome. And you talk about our institutions. There are fewer guardrails than there were 8, 8 years ago.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court ruling giving Trump a lot of immunity for acts performed as president just tore down one of those guardrails, Steve.
Yeah, look, there's a lot to worry about. Those who say or have said in recent years that America's constitutional checks and balances are going to be enough to save us, I think need to worry, right? I mean, Trump carried out maybe the most direct assault on American democracy in the history of the Republic in attempting to overturn an election and violently and inciting January 6th, a violent insurrection. And yet Congress did not hold him accountable, right? If there was ever a case that our founders had in mind for impeachment and conviction, it was Trump after January 6th, and congressional oversight failed. Same thing with the judiciary, right? Trump was charged with trying to steal an election in Georgia. He was charged with a set of felonies around January 6th, and the courts in 4 years couldn't hold him accountable. So our core checks and balances have failed to constrain Trump. You're right.
He got away with it, in essence, yeah. James.
So, Professor, here in the United States, 2024, we all saw what happened on January 6th, 2021. The Democrats accentuated democracy. They talked about it. It was front and center in people's minds. He's never actually said he was very much of a small D Democrat. All right? And this was all taking place in sub 4% unemployment. Okay, we did have some inflation. Actually, the truth of the matter is we had the most modest inflation probably in the Western world, but we did have inflation. But at the time of the election, incomes were actually going faster than inflation. Why does it trouble you that people just rejected the fucking idea of democracy? That we really don't care as long as we have cheap eggs? I mean, that's what really bothers me. You know, if this would have been in Weimar Germany and the fucking inflation rate was 35% and you were wiping your ass with Deutsche Marks, all right, you'd say, well, they went a little bit too far, and et cetera. But boy, it looks like the foundation of the desire for democracy in this country is pretty tenuous going forward. But what am I missing here, Prof?
No, it troubles me too, James. I mean, a couple of things. First of all, you can never depend, you can't leave the defense of democracy up to voters. Individual voters worry about a lot of things. They really can't be, it's too much to ask your average Joe voter to save democracy, to vote based on abstract principles like the rule of law and voting, et cetera. People vote for all sorts of reasons, as you know, but mostly for pretty mundane reasons, whether it's the price of eggs or whatever. But so it's really rare anywhere in history to find everyday voters putting democracy number one on their list of priorities. So Americans are not unusual in that sense. I think what happened is, one thing that distinguishes the U.S. from even Germany, definitely countries in South America, Spain, is there's no memory of authoritarianism. People take democracy for granted. We were born and raised with it. We assume, we believe we've always had it. And so we don't really think we can break it. A lot of Americans just take it for granted. That doesn't happen in South Africa or Brazil or even in Germany. That's one problem. The other thing we got to keep in mind is that voters have been voting incumbents out of office like never before in the last 5 years. I counted all the Democratic elections in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, South America, North America, New Zealand, Australia since COVID hit. 41 out of 55 elections, the incumbents got tossed out of power. It's 80% of the time. I don't know, honestly, whether it's inflation, whether it's the effects of COVID, whether it's social media, whether it's a combination of those things. But it's not just the United States. People were voting the bums out or voting the incumbents out everywhere in the democratic world. And this was one more case of that. The problem wasn't that. The problem was who the opposition was.
Again, it bothers me that this happened in 4% unemployment. And at the time it happened, incomes were actually outpacing inflation. Not by a lot, so there's no, people understand democracy. Up to this day, you know, I've thought about it, read about it, watched things by it. Why the fuck did a soldier in the Union Army die? If this would have been, if this would be in 1863, no one would have said, fuck it, I want cheap eggs, and if they want to have slavery, that's their business. I'm not going to exert myself by charging some fixed position because of General Rosecrans. This is just me talking. You're welcome to respond. I don't think we teach fucking civics anymore. I really don't. I don't think people grow up with any appreciation of what they have, how we got here, what it took to defend it. And, you know, we got a bunch of, you know, bros that want to go to UCF and grab their crotches. Well, it's a little bit harder than that. That's just my own view, but you can respond to my rant.
Look, I agree with you, and I share, I'm not going to share your language, but I share your sentiment.
I don't expect you to.
That language is very un-Harvard.
You got tenure.
Let me add one thing. I think the role of conservative leaders, or conservative elites, whether it's media figures, religious figures, or mostly Republican politicians, is critical here. For years now, Republican leaders have been refusing to tell their supporters the truth, right? The 49.8% of voters who voted for Trump in this election, they're never going to listen to me. They're never going to listen to some Harvard professor. But they will listen a little bit to figures on Fox News, to radio figures, to religious figures, to Republican leaders. If those folks had told their followers the truth, we'd be in a better place. We'd be in that we'd need a few fewer civics classes.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over, Albert. I want to come back to you because I want to talk to you about a particular country that I'm really attached to, and you're a Latin American authority, so I'm afraid I'm not going to like to answer them or give, but Al, go ahead.
Well, Steve, on your point, he won't say it publicly, but I suspect Mitch McConnell realizes he made a tragic miscalculation in February of 2021 when there was absolute justification to A, impeach Trump, and once you did it, to vote by a majority vote that he could not run for office again. He thought it would hurt Republicans in the short term. Might have been a hell of a lot better in the long run, but anyway, it didn't happen. You know, one of the things authoritarians do is suppress or try to suppress media criticism. Certainly that has happened in Hungary. The FBI designate, if he is confirmed, Kash Patel, one of his priorities is going after the media. I suspect that's real. Democracies, as you have written, die in darkness.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it's going to take for us to begin to take these guys seriously in their authoritarianism. They've been very upfront about it. Trump himself and the people he's putting in positions of power have been incredibly open about their authoritarian goals. And, you know, here I get back to James's point that Americans are just missing it. They're not getting it. They didn't get their civics class. So we need to take that seriously. I mean, it's hard. And so they will more than any administration in our lifetimes, they will use the powers of regulation, regulatory agencies, tax agencies, DOJ, the FCC, to create carrots and sticks in ways that get our media owners, or often media conglomerates, to temper their opposition, to maybe not do that investigation, not run that story, to self-censor. And we've never been anywhere remotely like this, at least in modern U.S. history. It's hard to know. It's hard to know how much CNN, ABC, CBS, NBC, and other mainstream media will buckle. Jeff Bezos's behavior doesn't generate much optimism in my heart. The one difference with previous periods is that because of social media, because of the internet, Americans who want alternative news sources will always be able to find it. There's not going to be the kind of media blackout that we had in sort of 20th century dictatorships or that we see in North Korea. The Americans who read the news, who care about the news, are going to be able to get it online. What I worry about is those who pay less attention to politics, those less informed voters who do not regularly seek out the news, who maybe turn on CBS News over dinner. Those folks may get a distorted picture if the administration is able to get the mainstream media to kind of bend its knee.
Let me try one more and turn it back to James. You have written that populism has become a problem, a danger, or a threat to democracy. I mean, doesn't that reflect the failure of progressives or Democrats to cede populism to the right? I mean, there's a perfectly, you know, legitimate, rational populism of the left, if you will.
Well, it depends how you define populism. Populism gets defined in a bunch of different ways. And the way it's defined in the United States, which is sort of a politics that that represents poor people, yeah, you're absolutely right. The way I was defining populism is more as anti-establishmentism. It's appealing to the masses to sort of tear down, to throw a punch in the gut of the entire elite ranging from, you know, progressive Harvard professors to Wall Street business people and all the politicians in between. That sort of populism can be left or right wing, but that sort of populism always ends up leading to a crisis of democracy. And I think that more than anything else is what Trump represents. The question of whether the Democrats can and should be doing more to appeal to everyday Americans, to working class Americans, that's a legitimate question. The Democrats have been bleeding white working class voters for as long as I've been alive, with a short reversal when Carville and Bill Clinton were in the White House, but that's just regular politics. The problem isn't big D Democrats' ability to win over working class voters or not. The problem is that we as a country, as a democracy, can't afford for the Democratic Party to lose. Parties lose elections. Parties run bad elections. Parties have good periods and bad periods. That's normal in a democracy. That has to be normal in a democracy. The problem is when the Democrats screw up, our democracy is at risk.
So Professor, I guess why I like you on the show, I'm supposed to ask what I think the audience wants me to ask you, but fuck it, I'm going to ask you what I want to ask you. Words get thrown around. Populism, the elites, all right? Or the establishment, which is my favorite, right? And I don't mean to be like a nitpicky guy here, but what is the establishment? I see these left-wing blogs say establishment Democrats like James Carville. How in the fuck did I ever become the establishment of anything? I mean, okay, so you say a Harvard professor is the establishment. All right, we kind of agree with that. On a scale of five, you got a five.
So ahead of you get to be outside the establishment, and I'm in the establishment. Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying, how did you and I get in the same frat? Okay, that's the thing that amazes me, that the head of Goldman Sachs, the professor at Harvard, and James Carville, who doesn't fit in here? Okay,
well,
I'm
not going to make a call on James Carville, I can let me take a stab at defining establishment for you.
Okay,
it's all the folks who are both engaged. It's the entirety, the collection of individuals who are engaged in politics and have some ability to exert influence in politics. That's the political establishment. The reason it matters is the establishment used to have a lot of influence over politics. I mean, if you go back, certainly before the 1970s in the United States, if you were a politician and you were not on decent terms with the establishment, you had no hope of getting elected. Right. If you were not on good terms with the leadership of your party, with big business or big labor, and with Walter Cronkite, you couldn't get elected. And now you can. In the 21st century, you can. It's totally transformed politics. You can thumb your nose, you can ignore the establishment and get elected. And that's really, for the most part, a 21st century thing.
So there's a political establishment, there's a financial establishment,
yep.
There's an entertainment establishment, there's a journalistic establishment, there's an academic establishment.
Sports establishment?
A sports establishment, all right? And most of the people, that's clearly the CIA was a lot of Princeton and Harvard, and I don't even think brown people could get in, but it's these things that become, and so populism, this guy David Shore, who's very smart, advocated that Democrats advocate popular positions. Well, gee, I wish the fuck I'd have thought of that 30 years ago. Like, you would take a poll. All right?
That is exactly how I thought about that.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, well, I like David Shore. I think he's a smart guy, but that's hardly an original thought. And so let me give you, because I think the insidious thing here, I'm going to go a little bit too long, but that's okay because I got you, is the effect of money and lobbying. So the two most popular things, and trust me on this, that you can be for in a Democratic Party that anti-establishment people like, middle-class people like, working-class people like, rural people like, small-town people like, midtown city people like, are one, raising the fucking minimum wage to like $14 an hour, and two, more popular than anything, is taxing incomes over $400,000 a year and using that money and redistribute it to young people who can't afford shit. We could not be for that, okay? We could not. The chief strategist of Harris's campaign was getting paid to keep carried interest, which is the most immoral fucking thing in the United States tax code. I'm sorry. Is there anything I say you disagree with?
No, that's a problem that predates Trump. It's a problem of money in U.S. politics. It was always a problem, but obviously got much, much worse in the early 21st century. And there are many ways for a democracy to be sick and for a democracy to die. Trumpism is one, but the insane and pervasive influence of money on politics is another.
So I'm going to let you go, but thank you for listening to our rant. I got to ask you one question because you're a Latin American authority at the core. And maybe my favorite country other than the United States is Colombia. And I work for Santos. But I think Colombia might be going in reverse a little bit. What's the situation down there? And also Bill Clinton's plan Colombia. And there's no one that doesn't say that saved that goddamn country. And it is a great, great country by any sense of imagination. But what's going on in Bogota these days?
Colombia is a weird place because it's had, by Latin American standards, pretty stable democratic institutions for a long time, for decades and decades, a pretty effective rule of law, institutions that sort of work at the national level. But it's also had the rule of law doesn't exist in much of the countryside, and the countryside has been overrun by either left-wing guerrillas or drug organizations or right-wing paramilitaries for decades and decades. So it's this sort of mix of a decent set of institutions in Bogota and the rest of the country being something more like the Wild West. And I think actually that over the last decade, 15 years, certainly since Santos's presidency, things have gotten better. The Colombia experienced horror in addition to the violence and the drug organizations in the countryside. Colombia experienced a terrible human rights situation in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was in office, during the Uribe presidency in the early 21st century. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of union leaders, human rights activists, lawyers, peasant leaders were assassinated, were killed. That's gotten a lot better. It got a lot better since the peace accord. It got a lot better since Santos was president. Colombia's human rights record is not night and day, but it's a hell of a lot better than it was 20 years ago. One other thing, the current president, Petro, is a controversial guy. He's got a little populism in him. He comes from the guerrillas. He comes from the left. Sometimes he says some pretty idiotic things. But the fact that the left could get peacefully elected and govern, this is the first time ever in Colombia, in the history of that republic, that the left could get elected and govern peacefully is a huge positive sign. It's a huge step forward. And I don't think, despite his rhetoric, which can sound a little Chavista, I don't think Petro's a threat to democracy. He's too politically weak.
Al, be sure that Maureen Orth gets an audio of this interview, because the only person that loves America, loves Colombia more than me is Chump Russell's widow, Maureen Orth. She has like fun schools. I love the country. I just love the
Medellin is full of Maureen Orth schools. She is fabulous. Steve, you've been a fabulous guest. The only slight concern I have is I think the resistance has to start sooner. I don't think they can wait for a year. I think too much damage will be done. But everybody ought to listen to you and read what you've written about the threat to democracy.
My fellow establishmentarianism. We're both members of the establishment, Steve.
As a fellow establishment ally of James Carville, let me just correct myself and say I agree with you. We would be a hell of a lot better off if the resistance were ready to go tomorrow. We will suffer a lot more if we're not ready to go.
Good point, Prof.
Well, let's hope people listen to you. Again, Steve Levitsky, there is nobody better at understanding the dangers of authoritarianism. Thank you so much.
I wish I could come to Harvard and take your fucking class.
Man. You're always welcome.
Thank you.
You know, James, the first two United States ambassadors to France were Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. They really set a marker, and for two centuries, there have been a number of worthy successors, Douglas Dillon, Sergeant Shriver. So who does Donald Trump plan to nominate to be the United States ambassador to France in the tradition of Franklin and Jefferson? Charles Kushner. Charles Kushner is his daughter's father-in-law. He's a convicted felon sent to jail for tax evasion, illegal campaign contributions, and jury tampering. Actually, it was really, really worse. While under investigation, Charles Kushner thought his brother-in-law might be testifying against him. So he hired a prostitute, lured his brother-in-law in, and secretly taped their encounter and then sent it to his sister. This effort to buy silence didn't work, and the prosecutor at the time, U.S. Attorney Chris Christie, said it was the most loathsome and disgusting case he had ever prosecuted, and Kushner was the most loathsome. So more than cheap hoods, mob bosses, and crooked politicians, the worst person Chris Christie ever nominated is the man that Donald Trump wants to send to Paris.
Well, there's nothing that you say that I disagree with. It's such an outrage and such a good outrage. I don't really want to come up with nothing, but I want to come up with a point of discussion here.
Yep.
You know, we like football. We like sports. And so this Houston guy who was suspended for three games for what they claim was a cheap shot on Trevor Lawrence. I've watched that tape 15 times, and I don't have any idea how the guy could have stopped. I mean, when he went into a motion, Lawrence was running the ball, okay? There's no doubt Lawrence slid. There's no doubt that the NFL rule is when a player slides, particularly a quarterback, that he's totally protected. But this guy got three games, and, you know, I hate to say this, and I don't say I like Lawrence a lot. He's Aziz is a black guy who's half Muslim. Okay, Trevor Lawrence was obviously a ball American at Clemson, all right, or a real All-American, won, I don't know what percent of his games. He didn't play for a very good team. No, it's not his fault. But I just wonder if some of this didn't play in, because I've looked at that goddamn thing, and I don't know how this guy could have stopped it. He didn't lead with his helmet. Of course, he knocked the shit out of him, knocked him out the game. There's no doubt, but a three-game suspension for something, I'm not sure he's at fault for. I'm really not.
Well, I'll take your word for it, because I did not look. I mean, I saw.
Look at it. Sometimes, and you're going to call a face mask, even though it was the guy was not intentional. If you touch somebody's, you have to have the rule. I'm not second guessing the rule. I'm not second guessing a 15-yard penalty. It was unfortunate, but it's got to be. But I just don't see, in watching that, and I like stopped it at the time that he started to slide. I stopped it because I'm just fascinated by this. And I just suspect there's something at work here. But I urge people at home who are fans to look at the tape of this and see if this guy could have done anything differently.
Because a three-game suspension is a really big deal and in the National Football League.
Yeah, I think Houston's not doing that bad, and the guy is really good. And you know,
they're a playoff team.
Yes, and you're affecting the playoff. And again, I'm no problem with a 15-yard penalty. There are plenty of people with intentional face mask and unintentional face mask. And I mean, we'll never know somebody's intent. But we've all watched enough football where we've seen this, and a lot of it is judgment calls. But I don't know how these motherfuckers in New York look at this thing like I did 15 different times and say this guy is worthy of a three-game suspension. I really don't.
Okay, everybody out there, watch it, because I think James.
But maybe there's something that I didn't see. Okay, I will confess to the fact that maybe there's something that New York saw that I. But man, I'll tell you, I'm gonna get some physics professor to do mass, speed, velocity, or whatever the thing is, and how could a human being change that trajectory? I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree with you. I haven't watched it, but you make a good
point. But watch it, and we're talking about it.
I do want people out there to remember that the chair that Thomas Jefferson once sat in will now, in all likelihood, be occupied by Charles Kushner, who Chris Christie thinks may be the sleaziest person he ever prosecuted.
That's why mine is not an outrage. I want to leave this as the out. Mine was not an outrage. Mine was a little kind of minor discussion point here. Okay, I don't want to in any way challenge this.
Okay, and now for the questions from our listeners. We covered some of those questions in our chit chat earlier, but we have some good new ones. James Bob in Redondo Beach, California, says, "Is it possible that having abortion rights measures on the ballot in some states gave people the ability to vote for that and then, based on their pocketbook, vote for Trump?"
It's a good question. There's probably some validity to it. But, I mean, I don't think that Trump... I'd have to look and see if he did appreciably better where you had these abortion referendums where you didn't. But I would be skeptical going in. I mean, it's a good point to make, but I hopefully somebody, you know, sits down and does a causation correlation, because I'm not sure. But it's... definitely a point that worth
it. Yeah, it is. I thought it would have a bigger impact than, at least on the surface, it appears to. But it is worth.
You know, we won all these. The other thing is, we won every election coming up to this. and we didn't win this one.
Yeah, and it did. It did have an impact in some congressional races. I know that for a fact. But you know,
well, probably did. By the way, we didn't talk about this, but what's that congressional majority going
to
be now?
220 to 215 by April, and by on January the 4th, it'll be 217 to 215, unless they want to withdraw some of those or postpone some of those appointments.
Used to be, you had the Southern Democrats, and they obviously had to break off. How many Republicans would they be in danger of losing, like, on a, we would all consider a bad
Well, game? I thought there would be more than lost in 2024. So with that caveat, usually off-year elections are more problematic for the majority party. And I think there's a good 8 or 10. You can just look at them now. There's still a couple in New York. There's still one or two in California, two states that did pretty well this time. There's two or three, at least, in Pennsylvania, one in Michigan. So, yeah, and there are always those that surprise you. So I think there are at least 10 or 11 that have to at least worry.
All right. Well, Matt, we always trust you for congressional analysis here. Okay.
Sue in Cumberland, Rhode Island, says, what is the likelihood that Ben Wickler, the chairman of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, will be elected chair of the DNC? James has said he's going to stay out of this because everyone's consulting him. I'm not going to stay out of it. There could be no better party chair than Ben Wickler. The DNC is not in great shape. You need someone who will pay attention to detail, can organize, can work with state parties. There was no better state chairman in the country than Ben Wickler. And I think he's perfectly suited to be the next DNC chair. I hope that's not the kiss of death.
Well, it would be a terrific party chair, I can tell you that. Like I said, I'm not going, I don't think it matter, but I'm not going to pee for one person or another. But anything you say nice about Ben Wickler, I would agree with it 100%.
Yeah. Andrew in Jacksonville, Florida says, why isn't there a Democratic version of CPAC? Dems need to showcase their talent and provide them an opportunity to set campaign themes and drive messages. James.
I love this question. And what drives me as much as anything, and people that listen to the show regularly certainly know this, I think that the level of talent that we have in the current Democratic Party is as high as I've ever seen in any party at any time. The problem for me is I know that, and a few other people know that, but most people don't. And one of the things that we have to do is figure a way to get all of these really talented, staggering people a forum to be heard. You know, it's the old stupid question you used to set up in college, and, you know, does a tree fall in the forest and no one hears it, does it make any noise? Okay. Well, we got a lot of trees falling out in forests and no one hears. And I don't know but I think it's a good freaking idea.
Yeah.
All right? I really do. And I'm going to suggest, I'm affiliated with a group called American Bridge, and you know, we do some pretty interesting events, but man, I want people to see this. And I want to have, and it dovetails with this, one of our listeners said, I love this question. I want to have a mini convention in 2026. I want to get these people out off the bench and in the game. They're just sitting there getting splinters, and they're all 350, 360 hitters. And no one knows who they are. So I like the thrust of this question. I had a more modest idea, but you inspired me to have a more aggressive.
Okay, Andrew, we're gonna try to plug your terrific idea. Rebecca in Sacramento, California, says, given that Trump never follows the rules, we must start thinking outside the box. Can Biden run FBI checks on all Trump's cabinet nominees, or set up other guardrails before he leaves the presidency? No, Rebecca, he really can't, because any guardrails he sets up, Trump will tear down. That's just the way Trump is. I think I go back to our conversation with Steve Levitsky. I think it's important to set up some kind of resistance. This is different than the need to reform politics and showcase the talent that James is talking about, maybe even building up the DNC. This should be a bipartisan effort of serious people to mount a real resistance to what will be the most authoritarian regime we have ever seen in American politics. And I think it has to be done soon. I wish I were more optimistic that it will be.
Yeah, I'd like to address your question. It's what it takes for an FBI background check. You know, the FBI agents you have to have, you have to set up the parameters. As soon as you tell the person you're going through a background check, I would do the same thing. I'd say, well, you got to get with my lawyer first. You got to get certain documents. I mean, the thrust of the question is good. The practicality of it is impossible, but it's not an intelligent question. It's just, if you have any idea what this entails, it just can't be done, but a good thought.
Yeah. Rebecca, let us know if you do. Andre, and Menominee, Michigan says, how long will it take J.D. Vance and company to start talking about the 25th Amendment, James?
You know, unless he suffers some deterioration with his voters, there's no Republican Party. By the way, there's no dissatisfaction of Trump. After everything they did, 34 felonies, trying to overthrow the government of the United States, being what could only, to me, be considered as open treason, all right? After all of that, they voted back. What are they going to get that's going to make them change their fucking minds? I don't know. And that is the depressing thing. I mean, I understand, but they don't care.
True.
They really don't give a shit.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing to reconcile.
Oh, it sure is. Linda, who says she's from gerrymandered North Carolina. Linda, you're absolutely right.
Okay.
It's the most gerrymandered state probably in the country. But next time, tell us, because the state's got so many great places. So tell us, you know, where you actually live. Great question. She says, can we explain the details of the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act and the Teapot Dome scandal? First, the Teapot Dome scandal during the Harding administration basically involved bribes and selling of oil leases, where the Interior Secretary and others profited mightily. The Teapot Dome scandal is going to really look like a little bit of shoplifting, I think, by the time the Trump administration is finished. It's already started. And so the Teapot Dome scandal was one of America's worst scandals. But Trump never is content to be second best, and I think he'll top it easily. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff was enacted, I think, in 1930. It was after the Great Depression began. And what it did was it lifted tariffs. There were other countries that followed suit, and it just made the global depression much, much worse. And it's a really terrible example, and it shows the dangers of tariffs.
Well, you know, I'm not awfully schooled in either one of these. The tariff thing just seemed like what would come across as a good idea at the time. It turned out to be a not very good idea. This happens all the time. The Teapot Dome scandal, I think it was in Wyoming, and it had to do with favoritism and oil.
It was.
Shit. The Teapot Dome, compared to the corruption the legal corruption that goes on today in Washington, is like pissing in the Pacific. All right? If you look at the total value of the whole Teapot Dome, and put it in $2024, I suspected, you know, it would be something. I'm not saying it wasn't wrong. I'm not saying it wasn't favoritism or people manipulating the system. But we become so, and every kid when I grew up, when you were a kid and you were taking, you knew about the Teapot Dome scandal. You might not have known the details of it, but it had a great sticky name. All right, the name, I suspect, in real terms, it was compared to Donald Trump, it was a chicken shit little scandal, but I don't know, I'm sure somebody will correct me and say it was worst thing that ever happened, but I don't think it's close to Trump.
James, how many kids today you think know about Jared Kushner's sweetheart deal with the Saudi sovereign wealth fund?
$2 billion. What about Charles Kushner?
Right.
But fuck, I what about the Russian spy out Trump's real estate? Man, where else could you go to find the right in front of you, open, breathtaking, staggering corruption? It's just unbelievable. It's beyond comprehension.
James Bryan in Port Washington, New York, asks, would efforts to resist Trump become more popular if House and Senate Democrats put young people and new faces in positions of leadership?
Well, it may or may not. I won't offer my answer. We couldn't hurt anything. We got to get young people out. We got to get them out. We got talented people in this frickin' Congress. All right, and we got talented people running, and you know, unfortunately, you know, the actuarial tables will work its magic. Not magic; it's not a predictable thing. But I think that our listener here has got a point. But you know, we've always no one gives it. The only way people give up power is they die. Okay, now I know there's been some that have not. And I just keep coming back to the tragicness of Joe Biden. It may be the good that will come out of this is people will see, you know, sometimes you just have to give up. But, you know, how long did Carl Hayden serve in the United States Senate? It's just a rule of thumb. People do not give up power willingly. See Chuck Grassley.
Well, I think, I really do think that Brian has a point. And I think that something's happening. The fact that Jamie Raskin is challenging Jerry Nadler to be the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, where Jim Jordan will do all kinds of irresponsible demagogic things, and Raskin is much smarter and more than his equal, much more effective than Nadler. I hope he wins. I think he will win. That's good. They need to showcase more people like Dan Goldman, Sheldon Whitehouse in the Senate. I would have certainly added Mikey Sherrill to that list, but she's going to run for governor. But there, as you say, there's a lot of young talent, and it needs to be showcased a little bit better than it has been, James.
Yeah, I tell you, the Jasmine Crockett, you know, right. from the one that it blows me away is the Virgin Islands delegate. I can't even think of a name.
Oh, is it Plunkett? Really Plunkett? It's not Plunkett. It's something like that.
Yeah,
God, she was good. She is good.
I mean, we got a slew of people coming up. I'm obviously very high on Ruben Gallego. He just had surgery, so I'm going to the fight Saturday. So he's not going to be able to go to the fight in Phoenix. But then, you know, look at fucking Steve Beshear. I mean, good God Almighty, this guy's winning states that we lose by 30, by 5 points. Yep. You know, look at our friend Wes Moore. I mean, get these goddamn people out of the playing field. Right. Josh, Mitch, any
of
them. We got some hopes. Fucking staggering group of them. Get them in the game.
You know, this is off subject a little bit, but the question was, would it have made a difference if she had picked Josh Shapiro instead of Tim Walz? I don't think it would have made a difference in any state but Pennsylvania. However, in Pennsylvania, it probably would have carried. It would have come close. Bobby Casey would have been reelected, and a couple congressmen would have won. So, yeah, I think Shapiro would have made a little difference. Wouldn't it change the
outcome? I talked to J.B. Pierce yesterday. The Casey race is the closest Senate race we've had since Al Franken.
Right.
All right? And you know, but when you get down to something like that, I'll just say that I think when it's all written and said and done, that they picked Waltz because they just didn't want, they were trying to deal with something that they never successfully deal with. That is a huge issue for the party, and that is coastalism. And for whatever it is, no one can choose where they're born or where they grew up. We're going to have Berkeley in the main line. And I think that they thought that this would make some sense. I think that, what the choice of Waltz is actually defensible, a little bit more defensible. And I understand and think, and they were never able to do much with it, but I think that was what was behind it. You know, he was kind of a coach, and, he was born in Nebraska. And I think they were trying to deal with a horrible problem that the party has. Just horrible. And people, coastal people, don't even have the remotest idea of how big of a problem they are in the Democratic Party. But it's a huge problem.
All right. Please keep those questions coming in. We thrive on them. And you're going to have lots of opportunities in the months ahead. Thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, The Washington Post, ZBiotics, and HelloFresh, and our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.